This is the Better Reading Podcast platform with stories behind the story, Jane's Be Better podcast, My Book Chat with Caroline Overington, and more. Looking for a particular podcast? Remember, you can always skip to it.
Welcome to the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story, brought to you by Belinda Audio. Listen to Belinda audiobooks anywhere, everywhere.
Hi, this is Cheryl Arkell for the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story. We talk to authors about how they came to tell us their story. Meredith Jaffe, welcome to Better Reading.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Cheryl. It feels like forever.
Yeah, it does. It's been a long time since we've seen each other, and we can't even remember where that was, or I can't remember where that was, but I remember chatting with you so distinctly. But anyway, hey, what a great book, The Dressmakers of Yarrandarra Prison.
Oh, thank you. It's a book that's very dear to my heart, I must say. It's one of those books that, well, it wasn't the longest between idea and publication, but it was kind of in the middle. It's my middle child in terms of complexity.
Yeah. So what is so strikingly different about it is that it's about a group of men, male friendship, and I'm wondering whether men have to be in a prison to have that bonding.
I do think, though, there is that thing, you know, like it's so, certain environments have their own culture, you know, like hospitals, high schools, you know, prisons, you know, there's certain sort of, you know, boarding schools, I'm sure, isn't, you know, there's just a thing, isn't there, where you put a bunch of, I'm sure universities are the same, that you put a bunch of people in that sort of enclosed environment, and it's sort of like a social experiment in some ways because it's so removed from the reality of everyone else's lives, but yet it is a reality in and of its own. So, yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe they need to be in an enclave, you know, in order to kind of bond.
I've got these two male friends. They live in San Francisco, actually, and they're besties. And I'm friendly with both of them. And I often, and I'm hoping they don't listen to this podcast, but often when I see one and he's been out with the other, right, I say, oh, yes, and how was he and what's happening? So, oh, I don't know. I don't know. And yeah. I'll say, and what happened with, you know, his son or something, you know, and he'll say, oh, I don't know. I didn't ask him. And
yeah, we didn't talk about that.
What did they talk about? What?
I know, football, baseball, I don't know.
Neither of them are sporty. So, I mean, it's the mind boggles. I can never work it out. And I often think that male friendship, and I love seeing it actually. I love seeing men hang around with men and have those bonds, but I often, they're not like us, are they?
No, and I think sometimes as a woman, the only way you get any real insight into male friendship or the functionality of male friendship is to be absent but eavesdropping. You know, I think as soon as you inject women into the situation, even if they're stone silent, the men behave completely differently than they would otherwise.
Yeah, I agree with that. Do you know what is really lovely about this book too is I don't know if there's a comparison because often these fiction books of this style are usually about women, aren't they?
Yeah, and the thing is, though, that this book was really tricky in the terms of so many ways because of authenticity. Yeah. And so in the first way, it had to be authentic is that the group that this is based on in the UK, Fine Cell Work, which inspired the novel, volunteers go into prisons in the UK. Like Australia, 93% of that prison population is male. So for me to make it women sewing a dress in a women's prison isn't actually all that authentic, number one. And number two, the thing that is so wonderful about Fine Cell Work in real life, connecting threads in the novel, is that these women are going in and with these big, burly, tattooed, mass-murdering, you know, violent men and teaching them how, you know, needlepoint. It is that anachronism that I think is actually what makes the idea resonate so strongly initially with me as the writer, but I think with people who've read it already, it's like, oh, it's the gentle art of sewing meets, you know, Wentworth. I don't know, you know, it's like a kind of really strange juxtaposition.
Mm. Tell me, how much research did you do in prison?
Oh, tons. Like, this may surprise you, Cheryl, but I've actually never been to prison. And so in terms of that authenticity, it was a form of world building. I needed to create how that structure worked. And so, yes, of course, there's some, you know, correctional handbooks. You can talk to the Department of Corrections, but you also need to get into the nitty-gritty of everyday life. So not just the routine of what time you have to get up, what time you get locked down. There's a whole PhD on comparing food in different prison systems across Australia. So, you know, that they have a very regimented diet in most places. But then again, that depends on, are you on a prison farm versus, you know, all the women's prison out in Western Sydney, which has a dairy. Well, it used to have a dairy. So there's those kind of elements to it too. And like, what's in a wet pack? You know, what toiletries are they allowed? You know, who would have thought they are allowed a razor? Because, you know, if you watch enough gritty prison drama, the last thing you think they'd be allowed to do is have a razor. We've seen what they can do with a toothbrush. So you've kind of got to also let go of all those preconceptions about what prison's really like. And the thing that really struck me was, in many ways, how boring it is to be in prison. There is so little to do.
Did that really strike you?
It really struck me when you're listening to, so with when you read prison memoir, when you read prison blog, when you read, for instance, the men that are taught stitching by fine cell work, and you read their letters and their posts and stuff, that's the thing that really comes through, is the too much time on their own to think about their own problems and to disappear into the self. So mental illness is much higher, levels of mental illness are much higher in the prison population, as are general health issues. So too much time to think also can lead to self-harming.
It doesn't surprise me though, because, you know, you're locked up from society and you're locked up from people you love and you're locked up from your social network and whatever. You know how we all have this fear, and I don't know if you have any of this, that recurring dream that may happen. And a lot of my friends have got, you know, the fear of flying, or mine is prison.
Oh, there you go.
Yes, being locked up, losing my connection with people.
And it is, the connection with people is a massive issue with the prison population. I mean, everything is stacked against them, sort of every statistic that you read about general society is exacerbated in a prison population, male or female. And so I think that in and of itself creates its own issues. If you've got mental health issues, you've obviously got anxiety over your disconnection with the people that you love and your normal routine. You've got too much time on your hands because there isn't enough work to go around. You're in lockdown more hours of the day than you're allowed out. Is it any wonder that people have so many issues, and this whole, to me, I guess the thing that struck me about teaching the sewing as well was about, it really ties in with rehabilitation. And like, can you take someone who's gone into prison and may have a life history of petty crime, full crime, you know, locked up family members, and then help them turn their life around so that prison is in their past and not, you know, potentially in their future again. So there's all those kind of different dynamics at play when you think about prison. It can't just be about, you know, well, you're banged up and you've done a crime and do your time and out you go again. It's sort of much more interesting in some ways just to, you know, hang out with them and see what it's like.
I don't know if you read about this recently, but one of the fellows that stormed the Capitol, who was in prison and not allowed out on bail, he was complaining that there wasn't a vegan or a vegetarian option.
Well, in prison. You know, that is actually reasonably common. It's a lot of the prisoners have to buy their special dietary needs from what's called the buy-up at the canteen. So particularly applies to Muslim prisoners and stuff, that there isn't the bog standard meal, which is from all accounts is fairly unpalatable at the best of times, is completely out the window for a lot of, you know, for members of the prison population who do have a special, I don't know, in Australia as well, like, can you have a kosher meal as well? You know, it's like, I'm sure there's all sorts of issues that we don't think about. And health issues is a very big one if you have a pre-existing medical condition and stuff like that. But I think the general point is, from the novel point of view, is just trying to sort of spend a lot of time in that space and trying to work out, how the landscape, you know, how the world building, as it were, of that prison that I've created impacts on the behaviour and shapes the behaviour of the men on a daily basis. And I should probably point out too that this is not gritty prison drama, maximum security breakout stuff.
Absolutely not.
This is the men and women in prison actually have a system where they work their way through the system as a categorised prisoner, so from A to C, just in simple terms, from A to C. And so this is actually set in the C wing. So these, even though we've got mass murderers rubbing shoulders with burglars and arsonists, et cetera, these are the men who have, through their good behaviour and, you know, self-rehabilitation, have actually earned the right to be in a more minimal security part of the prison. So we're not kind of, you know, we're not, you know, running our metal cups up and down the bars type prison story.
No. So tell me, where did the idea come from?
So I was, back in my days at the Hoopla, I used to interview a lot of authors myself, and so I was preparing to interview Esther Freud, the UK writer, and about her new novel, Mr. Mac and Me, at the time. So this is 2014, and like I'm sure like you, I just jump into Google and, you know, go swimming around in the pond and see what's going on, and I came across an article that she wrote for The Guardian on fine cell work, and I was like, oh, what's this? And when I opened up the file, and there's all these beautiful graphics of tapestry cushions and quilts and all this stuff, and she was writing about that organisation, and I was amazed, you know, just the beautiful work. Like, we're talking stuff that's commissioned by the Victoria and Albert Museum. The Queen has stuff hanging in Buckingham Palace. Elton John has stuff in his lounge room. I mean, apparently you walk into somewhere like Colfax and Fowler in the UK and you can buy cushions made by fine cell work. So it's become, even in the time I've been involved with their story, which is for 7 years, even in that time, it's just gone from strength to strength to strength. And I'm reading this and I'm going, wow, wow, wow. And then into my head pops this idea, what if one of the guys wanted to make his daughter a wedding dress? Mm. I have no idea. Nothing to do with anything that they do. Just that was the thought.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, I forgot to introduce you because we just jumped right into the conversation, right? So tell me a little bit about yourself and what you do, as well as being a writer.
Well, yeah, mostly I'm a writer these days, which is lovely. So these days I wear two hats. So the main hat, well, I guess they're kind of equal at the moment, but the main hat is I'm a novelist. So I'm working on a new novel at the moment. We've got Dressmakers of Yarrandarra Prison coming out next month, and I've got two adult novels behind me and a children's novel and a short story. So there's sort of that part of my life, and that's sort of been... Well, I started my first novel when my son was born, and he's just turned 13. So I guess it's 13 years of my life. But the sort of foundation years of that were spent at the Hoopla, where I worked with Wendy Harmer and Jane Waterhouse and Carolyn Rossler, and anyone who's old enough will remember that, the great halcyon days of the Hoopla. And I worked with them from the very first day to the very last day.
How long did that go for?
So it was a bit over 4 years.
Right, yeah.
And the formative part of that for me was learning journalism from some amazing women, and also, as you well know yourself, reviewing books every single week, preparing a column, you know, word to word count, et cetera, provides so much discipline and structure, but it also forces you to really think about or to really articulate what you loved or didn't love about a book. And it just does, by osmosis, filter into your own writing. It just really has a massive influence. I know everyone says to writers or would-be writers, you've got to read, but that's not good enough. You actually have to read critically, I think, to get the real benefit out of it. So that was sort of instead of going to uni and doing a Master's of Creative Writing, that was sort of my Master's of Creative Writing. So, yeah, that's what I do. And then when I'm not doing that, because, you know, what else do you do with your time? I run Storyfest down here on the south coast in New South Wales. So that's about to kick off in June. So that's another big task.
Tell me more about the festival.
So Storyfest was just a gang of us down here going, well, you know, regional festivals are so much fun to go to as writers. And don't get me wrong, you know, I've done a lot of work with Sydney Writers Festival, and I'll be here, you know, this year as well. But it's a very different vibe to your little regional festivals. And we live in a beautiful part of the world where dairy country meets the sea. It's so great surfing, great
gorgeous
food scene, tra-la-la-la-la. And because we're a major tourism town in the summer, or in the warmer months, the infrastructure is already pre-existing for a winter festival. So we just thought we'd give it a go, you know. And the first festival was in 2019. It just went off. It was just amazing. So many people. And you just realise how privileged we are in our own little writing world. So many people down here had never been to a writer's event / festival. I was quite surprised. So they were all, had no idea what to expect, and, of course, got the full-on treatment with what we would consider, you know, normal, and they just loved it. So they went more, and we were clearly planning to do that in 2020 and had the rug pulled out from under us, which so we elected because we had to preserve our capital as well. This becomes a big financial issue. So we just said, nah, we're not pivoting. We're just going to sit on it and we'll go for 2021. So, yeah, we're just launching ticket sales next week. So we're just, everyone's scrambling to make sure all the swans are swimming across the lake.
Yeah. Well, good luck with that. Tell me about you. So tell me where you grew up and how.
Okay, so, yeah, I'm a Sydney gal. I'm Northern Beaches born and bred, Avalon, back in the day when it was still on septic. Yeah, not well. Yes, but you've got to remember this is Avalon in the 1960s. So it was like septic tank, no guttering, everyone walked around in bare feet, you know. So even the millionaires at Palm Beach wore scrubby old King G's and had their boat, you know, their million-dollar yacht at the end of the jetty. But it was very, very fibro shacky kind of Avalon. It wasn't in Avalon as we now know it, but a wonderful place to grow up. And then we moved closer into the city for my dad's work when I was about 9.
Do you know, when I was little, I lived in Glebe, right? And my parents couldn't afford holidays. So, you know, the notion of going on holidays up or down the coast was just an unknown thing to my parents. But I did have a girlfriend whose mother rented a caravan at Narrabeen.
Narrabeen Lakes Caravan Park.
Yes, and it was my first holiday ever.
But you see, at the other end of the scale, like I was a horse rider. Now, at the time when I grew up on the Northern Beaches, the horse population on the Northern Beaches was the highest in all of Sydney. You'd go to places like Kirkhall Beach and they'd be tethered in the sand dunes. But there were horses, you know, down at Avalon, which is now the footy fields, and you could ride everywhere. It was amazing. And that's what, you know, it was that kind of place that you nowadays. And I used to ride my horses up and down, you know, between DY and Longreef Beach. You know, imagine if you tried to do that now, people would be calling the rangers on you. But we used to ride all over the place. It's like, oh, we'll just jump on the horses and go there. But then at the other extreme, I had friends who were so wealthy that they, you know, they had their holiday houses down at, you know, Whale Beach, Palm Beach and all that, and they trekked all the way from, you know, Tarramurra or Warunga or the eastern suburbs all the way to the far peninsula to go on holiday. So, yeah, not and quite the Narrabeen Caravan Park, but, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So you went to primary school, and was it an early kind of passion of yours?
Yes, definitely. I was always in my own little world. Or you read about authors and it's like we're all cast from the same die sometimes. It's like, yes, we all grew up reading masses of Enid Blyton and C.S. Lewis and The Hobbit and all those kind of fantasy novels seem to, you know, feature quite strongly, and adventure, you know, the famous five and all that kind of stuff. And so did all of that. And I also, when I was early high school years, I got into drama, and that is probably shaped me more as a writer than well, or as much as a writer as the reading. I remember reading with some interest that Kate Morton majored in drama and English at uni, and I majored in English and sociology, which I think is pretty obvious from this novel. But I did drama as a minor as well, and I did drama all through school. I mean, my dramatic highlight of my career, Cheryl, is I played one of the lead characters in the school play in Year 12, which was Pride and Prejudice, and yes, I was Darcy. I went to an all-girls school. The drama teacher made me cut my hair really short, which I know it's really short now, but like back in the day, I was like, oh, I felt nude, and I wore my jotties and I've got photos. I really need to burn them. I've got my jotties on and my long riding boots and all that, and I spoke in a very deep voice. And it really helped, though, because I was such a slack ass in high school that I was – my mother now knows this, so I'm not giving away secrets. I basically wagged most of Year 12. I was so over school. And the only reason I scraped through my English exam was because I could quote from Pride and Prejudice, and that was one of the set texts.
Right.
Well, shame on me.
But acting, I think, is another – well, I mean, it is another form of storytelling, isn't it?
So, yeah, yeah. You know, it really helps you when you're building scenes as well. Yeah. I think, like, when I'm writing the scene, sometimes I just write all dialogue to start with, and then I backfill and go, well, what are they doing while they're talking? You know, and as we know, we're always doing something else other than just talking. You know, we might be chopping the vegetables for dinner, we might be ironing a shirt, we might be doing a multitude of things. And I think drama really teaches you that stagecraft of setting that scene. And it is, you know, the sort of the classic thing with Chekhov, isn't it? If the gun's on the mantelpiece in Act One, Scene One, it has to be fired before the end of the play. And it is, you do get a very strong sense of that when you study drama at school and uni and stuff.
Tell me about getting your first book published. What was it and how did that play out?
So my first novel was The Fence. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't that was the first one published. It wasn't the first one written.
Very often that's the same story.
Yeah. But it was just that they swapped them around because they thought Christina was pretty heavy duty, which it is, The Making of Christina. And they felt that The Fence as a satire was probably going to get me a better audience than Christina would. And who was I just to argue? How would I know? It never been published. But the funny thing is that The Fence came out of a real neighbourhood dispute between us and the next door neighbours, that my husband was absolutely content to add fuel to the fire, and I, who hate confrontation, was like, just stop. And I was getting so stressed and distressed about this mounting tensions that suddenly the light bulb moments yet again, I went, oh, I could just put it into a novel. And so that's kind of where The Fence came from. So it was actually very cathartic for me. Not all of it's true, I might add.
Was it your first attempt at writing fiction? Or had you been writing before?
Yes, everything I've ever written has been published. And that only occurred to me. Wow. That only occurred to me quite recently, how lucky I am that I have never written a thing that's been rejected, which is probably means the next thing will be, so it's okay. But, I got a two-book deal on the basis of The Making of Christina. Then I
How did you get the deal?
Through my agent, and then she's a great believer in the two-book deal. So I had the strength of The Making of Christina, which was a completed novel, and a synopsis of The Fence, and she just pitched them as a two-book deal thing. And you don't realise when you've never been published like how big a deal some things are. Do you know what I mean? Like you just go, oh, great, I've got a two-book deal. That's fantastic. You don't realise until some times later when you've gone through harder times that you kind of go, oh, gosh, how lucky was I to have got a two-book deal. So
I mean, you're talking about it like it's an everyday occurrence, but for a lot of people it's really tough.
Well, that's what I mean. You don't have any sense of – because if you've never been published and someone says, oh, you're going to get a two-book deal and you're going to do this and you're going to do that, you just go, oh, okay, because all you're thinking is like, oh, my God, I'm going to get published. You're not thinking, is this normal? Is this what happens with everyone? And, you know, and you know, equally with the dressmakers of Yarrandale Prison, you know, that had massive structural rewrites. The catch cry from my my wonderful, wonderful editor was more heart, more humour. You know, sort of became the running joke. It's like more heart, more humour. It's like kill me now. So, you know, people see the finished product and you read a book and it might take you, what, 8 hours to read that book. It doesn't give you any indication of the years of agony, pain, or the months of agony, pain that, you know, the hundreds of thousands of words that may have been discarded in the process, the agonizing over exactly the right motif, you know, tra-la-la-la-la. It's a fascinating, to me, writing is like a two-act play. There's the creative, you know, the creation of the work, and then there's this part, which I love equally. It's then you go, well, what's the reaction to that? You know, same as the play, isn't it? You know, you write the play, you rehearse the play, you do the dress rehearsal. Opening night, is it going to be a blockbuster success, or is it just going to be a flop and it goes to off-Broadway in 1 week? It's a similar thing, you know, like, and it's pretty disheartening when every time you jump on and see what the best-selling books in Australia and you go, well, how do I compete with Bluey's Easter Egg Hunt?
Do you know what I think with writers? I think, you know, and you're probably right, it's the same with theatre and film and everything else, but you put your heart and soul into it for years and years very often. You know, you give up a lot to write. It's not lucrative in any way, shape or form.
No,
and then you put your baby out there and then everyone has an opinion.
Yes, yeah. And
you should be doing my job. I'm not as exposed to that.
But you see, you have to get comfortable with it too. Like, yeah. I remember somebody on Goodreads gave Christina a 1-star rating and I was like, oh, okay. And so I had to read what she said. And she goes, I hated this character. She really should have got off and done something kind of thing. And I was like, and I just cracked up laughing. I went, yeah, you're right. That's kind of the point, isn't it, that she doesn't do anything. But I know that some people weep into their pillow if they get a bad review or somebody doesn't like your stuff. But you've got to develop a thicker skin, but B, if your overall rating on something, or, you know, the overall opinion is that it's a 4-star out of 5, even though I think star ratings are a little bit cringeworthy, then who cares what the 20% that didn't like it thinks? If you've managed to win over 80% of the audience, then you're doing really, really well. Mm. Like, I think it can get really tricky when it gets into genre fiction as well, because you can really attract, like, they can be really hardcore as an audience. And
and I think very often the reviewers, what are they reviewing about? Like, when, you know, at Better Reading, we are talking to the genre audience.
Mm.
And that's a totally different conversation. And also, too, I say to people very often, like you, I mean, I've been in this industry for so long and no one has ever asked me what not to read.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. And I also get really annoyed with all the snobbery too. Like, I don't go to dinner every night and go, I want to have Wagyu beef with roasted potatoes and char-grilled broccoli and that's all I want for dinner every single night, thank you very much. Like, who reads like that? I don't read like that. I mean, sometimes, yeah, you might pick up a book and it's not read. Sometimes the reason the book's not resonating with you isn't the book. It's because you're just not in the mood for that book, or you've just come off the back of a particular other book that you're kind of still in cloud nine, or you're still sort of punch drunk from, and anything after that's going to really struggle. And maybe you're better off just not reading for a week until you've sort of recovered your equanimity. So, yeah, I'm not really – every time anything gets really literary, snobbery, I start to sort of have to bite my tongue or roll my eyes, because it's just like, get real, people. It's all right to have a dirty habit, you know, like to, I love literary classics, but I also like to go and buy a chocolate paddle pop, you know, like.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, we read so widely, but you're reading for the moment. You're not going to compare Murakami with a Rachel Johns, right? You know.
But equally, totally enjoyable books. So
exactly.
I've just finished reading Love Objects, Emily Maguire's new book. And oh, my God.
You how lucky I am? I've just come back from a Pilates class with her. Coincidentally, you walked into my Pilates class maybe 2 years ago and said, oh, Cheryl Arkell. And I was like, what? Emily Maguire. And I think we annoy our instructor because we talk nonstop. And
yeah,
I
you would. You'd be like, so what are you reading?
Oh, yeah, we talk nonstop.
Lucky
yeah.
It's not yoga.
Lucky. But isn't that just the best book? It's beautiful.
Oh, my God. It is, like, I'm sorry, everyone, but you have to go. And apart from anything else, you have to pick it up and hold that divine cover in your hands before you open it up.
It's tactile.
It's just so many wonderful things to talk about with that book. But that's a classic example. Like, Emily is a person who is not a literary snob, despite the fact that many would consider her, you know, a literary writer because, you know, she's got all these wonderful accolades. But when you open the page of any of her books, it's nitty and gritty, and it's like it's not always pretty. Like, she just writes stuff that is so visceral and so, you know, and she doesn't ever shy away from the fact that she, you know, she comes from that working class in the city suburb kind of environment, and that's what it is, and she wears it loud and proud. And with that, therefore, you get some wonderful insight into her work. Sorry, I'm not here to plug Emily, but, you know, it is a great book. I'm also reading Susan Thompson, so that's really good too.
Hey, Emily and I were just talking about that this morning.
Have you read it yet?
No, I haven't. She said to me, Cheryl, jump onto Susan Johnson.
And I said, do. Okay. I'm about 100 pages thin.
Yeah, and also another gorgeous cover.
Yes. Covers to, you know, I know it's shallow of us, so we're all very well, so we're not going to eat Wagyu beef every night of the week, but give me a good cover any day of the week. Yeah, I mean, it's part of, it's like when we used to collect records, isn't it? You know, and you'd go to the record shop and you'd look at the covers of the new whatevers, you know, Skyhooks Living in the 70s, great cover. And it does influence your buying choice to some extent if you're new to an artist, just particularly. Yeah. Or what, you know, great covers like Dark Side of the Moon and stuff like that. So yeah, sorry, I'm a bit of a cover nerd.
No, I agree with you totally. Now we've got to wind up because of course we talk. we overdid it, but that was expected. Congratulations, The Dressmaker of Yarrandarra Prison. I really think it's beautifully told story. It's quite unique, and I think everyone's going to be talking about it shortly.
Oh, good. Maybe someone else can jump on your podcast and talk about my book.
I'll say
hey, Emily, Susan.
Thank you so much, Meredith. Thank you for
thanks so much for having me, Cheryl.
If you'd like more information about Better Reading, follow us on Facebook or visit betterreading.com.au.
This podcast is proudly sponsored by Belinda Audio. Belinda audiobooks are available on CD and MP3 from online booksellers and bookshops everywhere, or you can download from Audible, Google Play, or the iBook Store. We've also created our own app called BorrowBox that's available from both the App Store and Google Play. All you need to do to get it working is to download the app, join your local public library, and you'll gain access to the world's best collection of ebooks and e-audiobooks available for you to loan on your phone or your personal device. Belinda, we're here to enable you to escape, imagine, grow, and be inspired through the power of storytelling. Belinda Audiobooks. Anywhere, everywhere.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
If you enjoyed this podcast, leave us a review and check out the other podcasts on the Better Reading Network.